Today's Teisho will be on case 31 in the Book of Serenity. Case 31 is Yunmen's Pillars. Introduction: The unique dynamic of transcendence. A crane soars into the sky. The unique road of direct confrontation with reality. A falcon passes the next country. Even if your eyes are like comets, you still don't avoid your mouth being bent down like a carrying pole. But tell me, what doctrine is this? Yunmen said, the ancient Buddhas are merged with the open pillars. What level of activity is this? The assembly was speechless. Yunmen himself said for them, on South Mountain, rising clouds, on North Mountain, falling rain. Verse: One path of spiritual light has never been concealed from the first. Transcending perception and objects, it's so, yet nothing so. Going beyond emotional attachment, it's meeting, it's meat, it's appropriate, yet nothing's appropriate. The scattered flowers on the crag, in the bees' houses they make honey. The richness of the wild grasses, in the musk deer they make perfume. According to kind, 3 feet or 10 and 6. Clearly, wherever you contact it is abundantly evident. Thank you so much for your excellent efforts this morning. This is day six of our sesshin, and for those who arrived on Tuesday, it's day four. And we have one first-time five-day person, and I'm so happy because, you know, it makes a huge difference to stay for those extra days. When people begin to do Zazen, and just coming to the Wednesday night sit is this enormous challenge. You know, so people come on a Monday or Friday night, we sit for 35 minutes, we do kinhin in between, and people get better at that. And then they come for a Wednesday night, and that's 3 sits in a row. It's a lot, it's an hour and a half. It takes a while to get used to that level of practice. Your earlier self would have thought, an hour and a half, I could never do that. But lo and behold, you know, after a while, you do an hour and a half and it's okay. And then I might say to that person, why don't you come on a Saturday? You know, come at 9:30. So they might come at 9:30 and do an hour and a half of sitting. And then have a little break and come back and hear Teisho, which is really another hour of sitting. And then, you know, they come at 8, and pretty soon they're doing half a day, or basically 5 hours of sitting, you know. And if you had said to them 6 months earlier, believe it or not, you'll be doing 5 hours of sitting on a regular basis, they would have been shocked, you know. And then basically people come for the weekend. The logic is they come to sesshin for the weekend, and getting through those 2.5 days is really difficult, right? And they think I could never do 5 days. But when they come for 5 days, they realize, every step along this path is energizing and liberating. And so, you know, what seems from the perspective of the novice, the beginner, impossible, you know, later becomes so liberating and energizing. You know, it's often the case during sesshin that people have trouble sleeping as the sesshin goes on. And often that's because sometimes they generate so much energy that they just can't sleep. That sometimes happens to me. It certainly didn't last night, you know. Last night I left the Zendo and got my kit and washed my face and scrubbed my teeth. And I lay down on the bed, and the next thing I knew, my alarm went off. You know, so it doesn't always happen. But I know that Genki Roshi routinely couldn't sleep towards the end of sesshin. So he'd be up, you know, I would sometimes come in and he'd be like reading a book or something. You know, he couldn't sleep. He got a lot of reading done towards the end of sesshin. I don't recommend that, but just generated so much energy. So I'm always glad when people can come for the full period of time. It's like night and day. Now, crossing that threshold of day three is like night and day. It's a different world. I mean, it's not the case that on day four and five you're free from fatigue and your legs no longer hurt. That's not true. But it's just qualitatively something is really different. Something is really different. I mean, you will have moments in your practice where you're really focused and your pain does go away. If that hasn't happened to you yet, it definitely will. And it's usually around day three where, you know, this still happens to me, you know, around the middle of day three, my legs were really talking to me. I injured my knee about a month ago. And a couple Saturday sits were really torture. My left knee was in a lot of pain, and the last Saturday sit was much better. The last two Saturday sits were much better. But around day three, that knee was really talking to me again. I must have pulled something. On the fourth day, usually it's a little sooner, but on the fourth day for me, it's just my legs get tired, but I don't have that pain. And that will happen to you too if you just keep practicing. I had that turnabout, I can remember long ago, I was at a sesshin, and I went into, it was like magic. You know, it was the middle of a day, and all of a sudden, you know, my knees stopped hurting, and I just felt like I was indestructible. And I went in to see Genki Roshi, and I said, Genki Roshi, I can't believe it, but my pain is completely gone away. And I said, I don't know why this is happening or how this has happened, but it's amazing. And he said, that's wonderful. And then I said, you know, and I'm sure I'll never feel pain again. And the next day I got up and, damn, what happened? You know, it was like, then you have to climb back up that mountain. It was like a little bit like having to climb. Now I have to climb back up that mountain again and get, it's like our awareness is so crude, you know. If we don't come to sesshin, you know, our awareness is so crude, we don't even know how crude it is, you know. But when you would come to sesshin, you know, it's like that sake on the altar. Those of you who, I'm not sure when I discussed this, so those of you who came Tuesday night might have missed this story, but my beloved first teacher, Takabayashi Genki Roshi, was from a rural Japanese background, and he was a, in America we would say he was like a hillbilly, you know. And he, just as in our culture, hillbillies make moonshine, right? Which is terrible grain alcohol. In Japan, hillbillies make their own sake. And Genki Roshi used to make his own sake. And he on one occasion brought a big jar, glass jar of rice, basically rice milk that was fermenting, fermenting rice milk in a jar, and he set it on the altar on day one of Sesshin. And every day we would come in and I would look at the jar, and the first day it was all milky, and the second day about an inch of it was crystal clear. And then, you know, like the second day or third day, it was like 4 inches crystal. It was so astonishing, right? This milky liquid was still there for the other, I don't know, 10 inches or the other 8 inches. But 4 inches of it now was just like absolutely clear. And each day it was like the fermentation process was continuing, and the rice, the crude matter of the rice milk was settling out to the bottom of the jar, and it was getting purer and purer. And this is actually, you know, one way to think about what happens at Sesshin, that, you know, our awareness is coarse. I don't even think this is a metaphor. I think it's literally true that, you know, our awareness is coarse. Our life makes our awareness coarse. We are in a kind of, you know, if I may say so, mentally impaired state a lot of the time in our everyday lives. And it makes us very unintelligent, very unperceptive, and we're sort of, it's like our thoughts so dominate our perceptions that we're sort of idiotic, right? And when you come to Sesshin and you begin to let the sediment settle out, you know, you begin to have less and less mental distraction and more just this pure awareness, this clean, pure awareness. And comes primarily just from sitting still and also from focusing on emptiness, right? This is like a little system that will produce this extraordinary clarity, this extraordinary purity. And, you know, if you just keep practicing, you know, by the time you've practiced a while, you know, when you get to day 5 or 6 of Sesshin, it's like that sake is crystal clear, you know. And, you know, it takes a while to get there, but once you're there, you know, if you just keep practicing, every Sesshin is like this. It's literally like going to heaven, you know. Or rather, I should say, like, the earth is an absolutely amazing place. But we are so crude-spirited a lot of the time that we aren't aware of it. You know, but by around day 3 of Sesshin or day 4 of Sesshin, you know, you look at the flower and you become the flower. Yes? You hear the bird and you are the bird. Everything in the Diamond Sutra, it says it's like a great body. Everything becomes like one great body or one great continuum of awareness. And this is, you know, this is really a priceless state, you know. And everybody has been here for days purifying, you know, the mind, purifying. And when you purify the mind, you purify the body and the heart. And the sediment settles out. And we become less crude-spirited, right? You can see things in a fresh way. You can experience things in this unmediated way. And it's true, when you get to day three, it's up and down. You get there and then you have this luminous clarity, and then somebody bumps the jar or you shake up the jar and it has to settle out again, and then it gets shaken up again. And so it's not necessarily a linear process. But you go through this again and again and again, and you're a very, very different person, right? And at first, you can achieve this. At first, it's very difficult for people to achieve that clarity at all during a session. And then if you keep going, you get there much sooner and sooner. And then, eventually it continues after session. And at first it continues after session for a few days, and then it continues after session for a longer period of time. And pretty soon your baseline consciousness has really been transformed. So this is Umon, or Yunmen, Cloud Gate, is, I would just say, an amazing teacher. I would put him right up there with Joshu as, personally, and this is absurd, and forgive me, but I would say, to me, Joshu is like just the greatest. And second greatest is Yunmen. I think that, we belong to the Linji lineage, but I would say Linji's down there somewhere. He's in the top 10, but I wouldn't necessarily put him at the top. Joshu, on the other hand, is like, he's the Everest of these high peaks, I think. And Yunmen is like, K2 or something, he's very close. This drives my wife crazy, and it is not, it's discriminating mine through and through, so. Like I'll say, that was probably the best Italian movie of the 50s. And she'll turn and say, why do you have to do that? Why do you have to rank all the movies? It's like my academic training. I think that was the best Italian movie of the post-war period. She said, why do you do that? So Yunmen said, the ancient Buddhas are merged with the open pillars. What level of activity is this? Now, if you've never done Zazen, the beauty of this koan is you have no idea what does it mean to merge with the pillars, right? The ancient Buddhas have merged with the pillars. What level of activity is this? And, for people who haven't done sesshin, this is totally impenetrable. But for people like yourselves who have come here, many of you have been practicing for years, right? This koan doesn't take long to open up. When you're on day one and you're worried about something at work, you might walk by, you might be in a beautiful setting, but you don't really see it yet, right? Day two, basically, you're a little less distracted. And you might be in a portico somewhere, and you might suddenly turn and realize, oh, there's pillars here, Because we just thought we're so crude, our minds are so crude. On day two, you might suddenly realize, oh, I didn't even see those pillars. They're very pretty, how nice, But around day three of sesshin, your mind is now empty of thought. And, when you look at the pillar, you become the pillar. When you hear the thunder, you become the thunder. Genki Roshi was good friends with a man named Soen Roshi. Soen Nakagawa Roshi was the probably the best haiku poet of the 20th century. And he said he once was at a temple with Nakagawa Soen, and they were reciting the Meal Sutras. And he looked over, and Nakagawa Soen was covered with tears, you know. He was actually weeping or crying, you know. He was communing with the pillar. You know, he was deeply connected to everything around him. But maybe he had become one with the rice, you know. One with the rice. Japanese people associate rice with mother, right? With mother. And if you have, rice is like sustains life, gives life, you know, so it's this unrepayable gift, that kind of idea, those kinds of ideas around rice. So it was probably, he was just probably, you know, communing with the rice. And indeed, you know, rice, for people all over the world, no rice, life is over. Right? I mean, it's not a matter of taste. It keeps people alive. It's life itself, you know. So this stage of communing with the pillar is something you will be familiar with or are familiar with, and it's the most wonderful thing in the world. It's so liberating to get outside of ourselves. He says this to his monks. He comes in and he says, the ancient Buddhas are merged with the open pillar. What level of activity is this? And the monks are all silent. Now, it's hard to know what their silence means, right? Does it mean they don't know, or does it mean they know? And they might all be thinking, well, here, there goes Yunmen again, right? You know, don't bother me. I'm communing with the pillar. Leave me alone, right? It's hard to know, you know, what their non-responsiveness in this case is. Are they stumped? You know, it seems hard to believe. So maybe they know. He's just stating the obvious. And he says, when nobody says anything, he says, on South Mountain, rising clouds, on North Mountain, falling rain. In other words, when you enter deep mushin and you purify body, mind, and heart, and you eliminate your obsessive thinking, you become one with the world around you. So basically he's saying, you know, I am one with the rising clouds on South Mountain. I am one with the falling rain on North Mountain, right? That now you've merged with the world around you, yes? So this is not the highest level of awakening, however, but it is a very deep. It's not complete awakening, but it is a very deep form of awareness that's on the way to that complete awakening. Everybody who does Zen eventually understands that situation. But the thing is, you know, you can't just command it to happen. You can't command it to happen. Our relationship to ourself and to the big mind is a complicated relationship. Because the big mind is not at our disposal. It's not at our disposal. It's not a tool we can use or a technique we can deploy to get reliable results. I had a student, she's no longer my student, but she did Zen quite seriously for a number of years, and then she stopped coming to Zen. And I saw her and I said, "So why did you stop?" I said, "Wasn't Zen valuable to you?" And she said, "Oh yes, among other modalities, right?" And I wanted to just throw myself in front of a car because I think that's a misunderstanding of Zen. I really do. It does have many therapeutic qualities, but I think you would go broke trying to use it as a therapy, as a modality, right? Because, you know, basically it's a very complex relationship to our big mind. The big mind isn't at our disposal. It's not a tool that we can deploy to get the results we want. And that's a good thing, right? Because very often the results we want are not the results we should want, really. Or we don't know what we want. I mean, this is a truism in many different, like in therapy, right? People will go, they'll say to their therapist, "I'm here because I feel exhausted all the time at work, and I'm depressed, and I want you to get rid of my depression," right? And you know what the person's often looking for is just like, well, okay, do this, this, and this, and it'll go away, and now you can get back to work, right? But you know, often in the therapeutic setting, you know, the therapist will get the person to rethink things that might have no obvious connection to what he thinks is his problem, right? And you know, and eventually they're not talking about work anymore. They're talking about many other things because the problem is so deeply seated. And as the process goes on, the person might realize, you know, really, my work situation isn't my problem. You know, my problem is this. So I think it's like that in Zen too. You know, we might have a goal, we might have an idea. But actually, you know, our big mind has its own agendas, and it's not necessarily going to give us what we think we want. It's going to help us re-experience our lives in a transformative way, and that transformative way might render, you know, what we wanted before valueless. You know, actually. And other things might take its place. So, the relationship, the way to practice Zen is not simply to have a set of tricks or methods that you deploy, even though there is this regularity. You know, I mean, around day three, everybody's going to go through pretty much the same process. That's true, I admit. But the relationship with our big mind is more complicated because we don't control it. We have to encounter it sort of on a bias or on a obliquely. You know, so you can't aim for it. You have to just make yourself available. And while you're working on your koan, it will come, right? While you're watching your breath, it will come, but you can't make it come, if that makes any sense. It's about stumbling into samadhi, stumbling into big mind. We have to stumble into it. When I was just starting out, I had read a lot of books on Buddhism, and I had read the books of D.T. Suzuki, who is a Japanese writer on Zen. And he talks about Kensho all the time. Kensho, Kensho. You know, and the koans are like this too, you know. Somebody will slap somebody's face and boom, you know, have a bigger weight. You know, he puts his shoes on his head, boom, you know. And the problem with this is people become very goal-oriented, right? It's very goal-oriented, right? I want Kensho at this session, you know. And if you do that, if you say that to yourself, you'll never have Kensho. You'll never, it's like, I do a lot of writing, and if you want to have, you want to make yourself totally miserable, say, I'm going to write the greatest article I have ever written, right? You're sure to go down in flames, right? Because everything you write is going to be, you know, it's basically going to be wrong. It's going to be, everything you write is going to be written under such pressure and so artificially. You know, the best thing to do is just have an idea that interests you, right? Have an idea that interests you and just go with it and see where it's going to take you. And you might think what you're writing is going to turn out to be this, but by the time you're done, it's something totally different. And then, you know, somebody might read it and say, gee, this is really great. You know, this is real. Or they'll say, you know, it's not your best work. But it doesn't matter. You just trust the process. But you can't make it happen. You can't, you know, people say, people are always surprised about Shakespeare, right? Because William Shakespeare is probably the greatest writer in the English language. I'm making another list, you know. but you know, most people say Shakespeare is the greatest English writer that ever lived. And, you know, people imagine Shakespeare as this lofty person who thought great thoughts and was, you know, really a Renaissance person. But everything we know about Shakespeare, a lot of what we know about Shakespeare doesn't add up to that picture at all. He apparently, you know, was very interested in making a lot of money, you know. And he wrote these plays, you know, basically to get big audiences, right? And to impress rich people and so on. And so his motives were, you know, he was sort of like cranking this stuff out. It's like, oh, they'll love this, you know. and this'll, you know, this'll be great, you know. And it's not clear that he was a great artist. You know, he might have been, you know, we kind of think of him as a sort of, you know, money, basically oriented by, we would say, less than, you know, 100% noble, lofty motivations. And this is something that's, but you know, I'm not so surprised. You know, he wasn't trying to write great art. He was just trying to write something. And he knew his audience, and he wrote this stuff, and there's obviously a kind of joy in what he's doing. You know, he probably thinks he's just writing potboilers. Nobody's going to remember this stuff. It's just some play I wrote called Macbeth. You know, who's going to remember this in 20 years, right? But, and so he just had a good time writing it, you know, and it was a hit. You know, lots of people came to his theater, and he was happy, you know. This idea that we sort of stumble into the answer to our koan, we stumble into deep samadhi, or stumble into enlightenment, is so important. It's the right, you have to have this kind of relationship with your big mind. You don't set the, you don't write the timetable, you don't write the schedule, the agenda, right? It has its own agenda. And you don't, we generally don't know what we're doing. We generally don't know what we're doing. We don't know where we're going, but the big mind has its own plan for us, so to speak. Right? And we just have to keep entering this blankness and wait for something to turn up. It sounds like a crazy method, right? But it's really what Yunmen is talking about. You know, Yunmen has this wonderful, wonderful saying here. this is not part of the koan, but Yunmen said, everybody has a light, but when you look, you don't see it. It's dark and obscure. Everybody has a light, but when you look, you don't see it. It's dark and obscure. In other words, you know, there are in New Age circles, there are lots of people who say you should meditate on light. Meditate on light, you know, but that's very artificial. You're holding an image of, in your mind that you think is what you should be getting close to. And you're focusing on that image, and of course all you're doing is focusing on an image that you yourself chose. So there's nothing liberating about that, actually. When people plunge themselves into wuxing, you know, you're in a situation where your big mind can begin to guide you or speak to you. But it doesn't speak to you in words. It doesn't say, Bill, you know, the answer is, go in and clap your hands, right? You know, you go in and clap your hands. It's like, thanks, big mind. No. It's more like a compulsion. It's more like a feeling. It's like a kind of feeling or a compulsion. You know, compulsions are fascinating. You know, because compulsions have like a negative quality, but there are positive compulsions too. So, you know, some people build up so much energy or tension, they have to release it in ways that are socially unacceptable, like setting things on fire, right? this is, you know, you've heard this firebug. He's a firebug, you know. In the movies, there's always like some guy with dark circles under his eyes. He's a firebug. But, you know, it's not so... these people are not monsters. They build up all of this tension and they can't release it, because they don't know where it's coming from, right? They don't know. So they have this, they've developed a strategy. They do something that releases the tension for them. It doesn't get to the source, but it is cathartic. You know, setting something on fire and watching it burn, suddenly they feel like release. It's like, oh, that's so much better, you know. So that's an unhealthy compulsion. But look, you know, they're also, you know, like artists, they just have to paint. They have to. They build up so much energy, you know. They have to get in there. They have to get their hands on the paint, on the brushes, you know. And they paint, you know, like 12 hours or something until they're drained, right? And I would say that's a healthy compulsion. Compulsions that are destructive. But, you know, in a different society, firebugs might be really valued, you know. If we really thought a good fire was something to, you know, that's a real fire. You want somebody who's compelled light these fires, you know. In our culture, we reward people who paint. I remember reading this wonderful article about the sculptor Giacometti. And this guy stayed with Giacometti for a couple weeks. And if you've ever seen his stuff, it's pretty interesting. He said, you know, Giacometti, they would go to Giacometti's studio and he would have these clay figures he was working on covered in damp cloth so the clay doesn't dry out. And Giacometti would get into the studio and he'd light his cigarette and he'd start unwrapping this figure, and he'd look at it, and then he'd just shake his head like, I just don't think I can do this. And he'd wrap it back up. He goes, let's go get a drink. And then they'd just walk around town and talk and go have lunch and smoke. And this would go on for two or three days, and then he said, you know, finally Giacometti would come in, they'd sit down, he'd sigh, take the wrappings off, and then he said he'd just start working. And he'd work for like 12 hours. And it was just like, and you couldn't even talk to him. It's just like in the zone, right? In the zone. And I think Giacometti had his own practice, right? I mean, he was there. He came to the studio every day or often, and sometimes it wasn't there. But then he would come in, and it's like the big mind was there. It was ready, and he just disappeared into big mind activity. And, you know, basically he didn't know where this was going. You know, he didn't plan it out in advance. He was going by how it felt, right? So, you know, he had a big block of clay, and he was just, what the guy said, you know, like the pieces were, clay were just flying off into the air. And the thing was getting thinner and thinner, you know, and until it would turn out to be this very, very elongated figure of a human being. But in the process, he wasn't quite sure where this was going. It was like he might just take all the clay away and there wouldn't be anything left, but he trusted the process, you know. And this is what the life of Zen is all about. You know, we're artists with consciousness, you could say, you know. And we you have to go to the cushion, and some sits, you know, it's there, and some sits it's not there. You have to make yourself available. If you don't go to the cushion, nothing happens. You know, sometimes the thunder comes and sometimes the thunder doesn't come. But if you aren't listening for the thunder, you never know. If you're inside watching TV, you know, we had this incredible experience a few days ago that most people in New Jersey missed, right? Because they were all in watching TV or on their or texting or something, you know. So if you're not on the cushion, things are not going to happen. But you can't make it happen. You just have, what do? We keep emptying ourselves out. And you're preparing the way, preparing for the arrival of big mind. And you have to get things ready, right? It's like, I'm going to get it ready for big mind. He's coming or she's coming when she comes, right? And so you just keep emptying out, emptying out, emptying out, emptying out. Moo, moo, moo. And your mind is blank, 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 blank. And then, you know, the subconscious, what the Mumonkan calls subconscious stirrings, right? Again, you know, something might pop into your head. You might have an image that you want to share with me. That's great. But often it's a feeling. You know, it's a feeling is your guide, or like a compulsion. You know, I feel like I'm going to scream. It's like, well, scream, you know, please, you know. People, sometimes people have hesitated to call moo in the kitchen. Like, you know, why? And they say, well, what will people think? It's like, this is New Jersey, you know, nobody cares, you know. You can scream, you can do whatever you want, you know. Nobody's going to care. So, I wouldn't worry about what the neighbors will say, you know. But trust the big mind. That's what he's talking about. And communing with the pillar is... communing with the pillar is this is what we all have to do, becoming one with. Now look, you know, we don't choose the pillar, you know. So if you say, you know, when you get into deep samadhi, it might feel like your head is actually a block of wood. You know, I don't know if you've had that experience. But you're sitting there, and maybe pieces of your body feel like they're disappearing. Maybe only a small portion of your body still seems to be there. But your head may feel like it's stuffed with cotton or it's made of wood. You know, Daitetsu was his Dharma name. And it means great blockhead. And you could think, wow, you know, somebody didn't like him, right? You know, his teacher didn't like him. But to call somebody a blockhead, again, it's a Zen. Anybody in Zen knows, oh, well, congratulations, you know. Because your mind is empty, blank, and dark. And often it feels somatically like you're, and again, if you're not having this experience, people come to me and say, I never have these experiences. My head never feels like a block of wood. It's okay. It's okay. You know, it doesn't have to. It manifests differently in different for different people. You know, some people feel like they're emptying out. Some people feel like they're made of stone. It doesn't, how you experience samadhi is definitely going to be a reflection of your particular embodiment, your particular cognitive style, and so on. But basically, it's common, though not everybody does, that you feel like your head is made of wood, or it's full of cotton or something, right? And we think of, you know, the state we need to be in on the cushion is not crisp and precise, like when you're doing math problems. It's foggy. It's between, it's not dream and it's not waking. It's another state of consciousness. It's a dark mind. It's dark mind, right? It's receptive. It's thoughtless, right? Yunmen said, the ancient Buddhas are merged with the open pillars. They didn't choose the pillar chose them. You walk outside, if you say, I'm in samadhi, I'm going to go out and have a good experience of this flower, and you look at the flower, nothing. That's not how it works. But what happens is you think, oh my God, I've got to take a pee. And you've been sitting deeply, and on your way to the bath, you're thinking, got to get to the bathroom, and then you suddenly look at this flower and you become one with the flower, right? It comes at us from the side. It's like you stumble into it. Boom. See? Boom. Yunmen said, the ancient Buddhas are merged with the open pillars. What level of activity is this? The assembly was speechless. Yunmen himself said for them, on South Mountain, rising clouds, on North Mountain, falling rain. Verse, one path of spiritual light has never been concealed from the first, transcending perceptions and objects. It's so, yet nothing so. Going beyond emotional attachment, it's appropriate, yet nothing's appropriate. The scattered flowers on the crag, in the bees' houses they make honey. The richness of the wild grasses, in the musk deer they make perfume. Each, this energy manifests itself in each creature a little differently, according to kind, 3 feet or 10 and 6. Clearly, wherever you contact it is abundantly evident.